It's like any of the surgeries that we do. To someone who doesn't know you, then we would want them to not know that you've had surgery. But obviously people who you know, they're going to know that you've had surgery. And that's where I'm trying to pitch sort of most operations that I do.
Hey ReFam, my name's Kate and welcome back to Keeping It Real, the podcast trying to eradicate the too tight facelift. On today's episode, I'm joined by Richard as he explains how you can achieve facial harmony through combining different procedures. He explains why some patients look like they've been caught in a wind tunnel and how to avoid it, why the conservative option is sometimes the best in the long run, and how combining certain facial procedures can lead to a smoother result. For cosmetic surgery, when it comes to facial stuff, I think probably enough celebrity examples to prove that it can be a bit of a touchy beast. What I wanted to maybe talk about today was just how you combine those different procedures so that you're ending with something that looks a lot more natural and less kind of like overdone or like they're stuck in a wind tunnel. When a patient comes in for a consult, how do you assess what they need and how these combinations might work?
Like with any other surgery, you always start with what their primary concern is. So you know, some people come in and their primary concern is their eyelids. So you might start there, but then you've got to assess all of that in combination with the rest of their face. So someone who, say, use eyelids for example, they may have some crowding or lowering of their forehead, which is contributing to the upper eyelid skin excess. So then you've got to reassess their brow and see if they wouldn't be better off having a brow lift and then needing less of an eyelid. Because for those watching, and if you're not watching, go and watch on YouTube, I'm lifting up my eyebrow and you can see when I lift up my eyebrow, it takes some of that skin out of the eyelid. So then once you then extend on to the, and not that we're trying to upsell people, but, you know, if you want to try and treat the whole area, you then need to look at the mid-face, the jowls and the neck as well. Because what you don't want to end up with is, say, one part of the face looking rejuvenated, but then sort of the lower face not in harmony with that.
Yeah, right. What causes that wind tunnel look that I think we know, that like really tight skin, and how do you avoid it?
So again, I think it comes down to treating the whole area. So it depends on the vector that you're pulling. So what I mean by that is what direction that you're pulling the facial skin. So I think there's two things actually that contribute to it. One is the direction that you're pulling the skin. So if you're pulling it too far sort of horizontally, to avoid sort of bunching in this area, then that can sort of look, not right. Mm-hmm. The other thing is if someone is actually pulling the skin too tight to avoid or delay sort of a revision. And I've always taken the position to make it look natural, and then if someone needs a revision down the track, well, then they need a revision down the track, but it's better than looking weird for 10 years. So then in 10 years' time, you catch up and then it looks normal.
Yeah.
I'd prefer to say, well, look, facelift, there's no time limit on how long it lasts. Like, you'll generally always look better than if you hadn't had a facelift. So it's just when you get to the point where you starts to make you feel uncomfortable. And then the other thing, so some people pull in a different direction because to avoid all the bunching. So sometimes if you extend that into a brow lift, you can avoid that, so then you're pulling in a better direction. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing is operating on the deeper muscles, and then that pulls in a funny direction. So then you'll often see sort of this funny crease
going like across the mid-cheek.
Yeah. So I think all those sorts of things is sort of that sort of fake or windswept look that you're talking about.
Yeah. Windswept is a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
I heard this lady the other day go, if Madonna can't find a surgeon to do it, I'm sunk. She made me laugh because Madonna's just so like, I do think hers is filler, to be fair.
I think it is, but it just goes to show that it's not a matter of how much money you've got. Mm. You've got to do your research and look at people's results and feel comfortable about what that, they can achieve what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, because I do think that like the kind of pervasive image is that really like I before probably looking at photos with you, if I thought of a facelift, I was like, oh God, like it's just, it seems so over the top. And it's like, you think of these people that are like, oh, they're just like trying to fight aging and they look like, they just look so weird. And then you look and you're like, oh, I actually would never know that person had a facelift. Yeah.
So I think that's a really important point. And it's like any of the surgeries that we do. To someone who doesn't know you, then we would want them to not know that you've had surgery. But obviously people who you know, they're going to know that you've had surgery.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm trying to pitch sort of most operations that I do.
How important is the consultation in terms of figuring out patients' goals and expectations?
Well, it's really important, obviously, for that. So knowing what are the areas that bother people. But the other part of the consultation, so that's the first part of the consultation. Probably the second part is, you know, background history, other health issues, medications they might be on. So other things that might impact the surgery and recovery. But then the second part is explaining the surgery and talking about all of the risks. So the consultation, actually finding out what people want is usually pretty straightforward. You know, examining them also for a face is pretty straightforward. So most of it is really about explaining what you're going to do, talking about the risks, explaining recovery, going over before and after photos. So that's probably 30 to 40 minutes. Of my consultation.
Yeah, and like making sure that their expectations are in line with what's achievable as
Yeah. Like, you know, if someone wants that windswept look, I'm probably not the guy.
And, you know, the girls are clamoring for it. Yeah. Are there specific facial features that commonly are improved by that kind of combination?
Yeah. So I think eyelid surgery is a classic. So if you take the upper eyelid, having sort of your brow sitting sort of not over the bone, maybe sitting a bit higher, and having some gap between where the eyelid starts and where the eyebrow is, particularly towards the outer part, the lateral part, and then the upper eyelid having a nice fold, so not having a hooding of the skin. And for anyone playing at home, if you lift your eyebrow up, it will clear some of that skin that's in that upper eyelid. And then having a nice crease. So they're things that make the eyelid look more youthful. But the other thing that patients commonly say is it makes it easier putting on your makeup and things like that. Yeah. So it's not smudging and things like that. Then the lower eyelid, and there are a couple of things there. So you can have loose skin, but also sort of that puffiness. And some people notice it more in the morning or night. Everyone's a bit different. Sometimes it's there all the time. And then you also get sort of because the mid-cheek drops, we were talking about that the other day, you see more of that lower eyelid, which makes that look longer as opposed to the cheek sort of blending into it. And then as you keep going down, we'll go from top to bottom.
Yeah, do it.
You see the mid-cheek sort of drop down, which then creates that fold. The nasolabial fold, which sort of runs from your nose down to the corner of your mouth. And then jowling, sort of that's where skin is hanging down below the jaw. And then the last thing is loose skin in the neck. So, yeah, all of those things can be addressed with it.
I thought you explained it really well the other day when you were saying it's like you then fix the neck and that pushes it up to the midface and then you've got to push it up to the brow and it's kind of like it all gets put up like a...
So in a way, sort of the longer the incision is, the better you can redistribute all the skin without getting some of that bunching. You'll often have patients who come in and go, I just want a neck lift, okay? And if you do that exercise at home, that like what you were just doing, you just push that up. Well, just lift that up. Well, where's all of this skin going to go, okay? So then you're already getting into the face. And then you lift this part up and it's like, well, where's that going to go? And so it ends up going, you know, further and further. But
yeah,
it sounds like you're doing more, but it's keeping everything in harmony, as you said at the start.
Yeah. In conversation with a recent podcast we've done, is that something that can be helped with 3D imaging or anything in terms of plotting out what that would look like?
No, we don't really use the 3D imaging for that. You can can do it, and more as a research tool, I suppose, mm-hmm. and measure volume. So sort of measure the volume that's in the cheek before the surgery and then the volume after. Mm-hmm. I've never really done that, but the simulation doesn't work for facial.
Facetune's better.
Yeah, Facetune's better. Correct.
What challenges are there to competing multiple facial operations?
In general, with any facelift, as we've talked about, is redistributing the skin and pulling the skin in the right direction and not ending up with bunching. You're also, you need to lift up enough of the skin so that you can actually pull on it. So if you're not releasing enough of the skin, then you're not going to get a nice pull on the skin. So you won't be able to, say, address, sort of as you go more towards the nose, address all of those folds as well, or and the same in the neck. And then you've got to do all that, but protect the nerve as well. So there's a very important nerve which sits under an extra layer but controls all the muscles of the face. So you need to, obviously, you want to be avoiding that. And then something that a lot of people maybe don't think about is preserving the hairline. So people do different techniques. I tend to do a hairline incision. So my cut is at the hairline. So when I'm pulling the skin, the hairline stays in the same spot. So some people in front go, instead of following the hairline, say here, they'll go up through here.
Oh.
And so when you're then pulling that skin back, you move that hairline back. So which is fine, except if you know what you're looking for, it's one of those stigmata of facelifts.
Yeah.
So people who know will go, they've had a facelift.
And would
– so the common places
that would, that reduce the hairline, or would hair start growing out of the new part of the skin?
It would reduce it because the cut's here.
Yeah, okay.
And then you pull that skin, that's the skin you're cutting off.
Yeah, right.
So then the hairline goes back. So it still ends up being a hairline incision. But yeah, you've moved the position. And the other part where people commonly do that is behind the ear.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of it following down through here, there's a little step here at the back, because people make that cut going.
That one kind of feels like it matters less.
Probably.
Because it's like if you're older and getting a facelift, then maybe your hair is not as thick and luscious as it was.
Yeah. So sometimes if people say don't have enough gap here.
Yeah, right.
You might want to lengthen that a little bit.
Yeah.
So cut out some skin. And then the other one is the earlobe. So earlobe is a really important part of a facelift. So if people don't treat that properly, you get that Dr. Spock, where it looks fused. Maybe do it on this ear. It looks fused
into
the ear, so you want to have an earlobe that's
free. Not everyone has that, though.
No, they don't. So sometimes in a facelift, you'll actually create that.
Right. Yeah. Oh, you'll give them an earlobe for free.
Yeah.
Wow.
And probably the last thing, so these are all the things, for people walking down the street to look out for.
Yeah.
So the other thing is looking at the skin right in front of the ear. So it's very specialized skin. And so some people put that incision sort of behind, it's called the tragus.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're pulling normal skin onto here. And so you'll see that, and it looks thicker skin. So you don't have that sort of nice scalloped look in front of your ear.
How do you navigate that very fine line of enhancing facial features and keeping it looking natural?
Yeah, I think it's a lot to do with avoiding some of those stigmatas.
Mm-hmm.
So you want, like, any of those things would be a telltale, maybe not to the average punter, but to people who would know, or if people who are actually looking for it after you've watched this podcast. So balancing, trying to avoid all of them, firstly. And then I think pulling the skin in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say pull the skin sort of too vertically or too horizontally, it's not going to look as natural. So you want to sort of pull the skin in the sort of natural direction that it should go.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing that, then it should look natural. And so some people you're a bit limited if you're maybe not doing a forehead at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll hear some of the discussions about deep plane or sort of other operations that involve the SMAS, which I address, but in a slightly different way. And that sort of then also restricts the which direction you can pull the skin a little bit. So I like to really, because it's mainly the skin that's sagging. The muscle isn't sagging so much. So you don't, that's not the main thing.
Can muscle sag?
Yeah, it can, but that's not generally, like when you sort of have a big jowl.
Yeah, it never even occurred to me.
Like it's not, that's skin. That's not.
It's gravity, maybe.
Yeah.
Are there any age-related considerations you need to take into consideration when you're doing those surgeries?
Not really. I mean, other than just general. I mean, as you age, medical health issues do accumulate. So people are more likely to be maybe on blood thinners or have some other medical conditions.
What's the oldest person you've done a facelift on or you've heard of?
Oh, yeah. 70s, 80s, like
crazy.
Like if someone's fit and well,
you
would modify maybe what you do. Like you maybe wouldn't do quite as extensive. So
it'd be weird if they came out looking 50.
Yeah, it was the old hand face ratio that I've talked to you about. So you don't want to look too, you don't have too much of a disparity. I think 2 to 1.
Like
If your face looks 40 and your hands look 80, you've gone too far.
Terrifying. Yeah, that's a very good call. How do you think face surgeries have changed since you've been a surgeon?
Oh, it's kind of gone full circle a little bit. I mean, the original facelifts were predominantly skin, and then it moved more to a SMAS plication, which was just tightening, not releasing as much skin, but relying on the SMAS to pull on it. And the SMAS does pull on the skin, but not as well as the skin pulls on the skin.
And for everyone playing at home, can you explain what the SMAS is?
The SMAS is the layer that sort of sits above the nerve.
Mm-hmm.
So all the muscles are below all that and the nerves are all below that. Some of the muscles sort of blend in, so the muscle around the eye is part of the SMAS. One of a muscle in the neck called platysma, that's also part of the SMAS. There's still a very, people would have heard of the deep plane facelift, which, you know, is a very popular technique at the moment, but that relies on not lifting as much skin and then pulling on the SMAS, which is then pulling on the skin sort of towards the nose, which it does pull on it, but, you know, the question is that the right vector and is that the right part to be pulling on, or is it better to pull on the actual skin that's droopy? So
is it common to pull, stitch it on, look at them and go, that's a bit weird, and then like release a bit or whatever?
Yeah. So you sort of like, it's called tailor tacking, not named after Kim.
Yeah, I was going to say, my God, I should add her on the pod.
So you pull it, the skin in a sort of the direction that you want, and you have a look and make sure that's sitting right. And then at a couple of key points, you'll cut into the skin, like say at the sort of base of the ear. So you'll cut into there to the point where you can see sort of where you're going to stitch, put a stitch there, and then the cut will continue around the hairline. So you've got that point and then you've got skin hanging above it. Sorry, I am showing this on video. And then you'll cut skin so that it's sitting flush with where the cut is.
And because you're obviously very swollen when you come out of a face surgery, but when they're on the desk. Do they, like, does that kind of impact it at all, or is it you're still in that zone?
No. I mean, the swelling at that point's mainly local anaesthetic, which mostly would have dissipated, so it doesn't really impact it. So it's the interesting thing is, so everyone cuts the skin in a facelift really with scissors, and for every other operation, we cut the skin with a scalpel. But always in a facelift, I've always done it with
scissors. Why?
Because you've just got a bit more control, and you're not cutting. Usually when you're cutting the skin, you're cutting it and it's sort of intact. Whereas this, it's like a sheet that you've lifted up and it's not.
And is it a lot thinner?
Yeah, it's pretty thin.
That's so interesting. You have more control with scissors. I so would have thought you have more control with a scalpel.
Well, but also, you also want to cut along where the cut edge is.
Yeah, right. All right. In terms of recovery,
yeah.
Is it in terms of combining multiple facial procedures or doing one, is it a similar recovery?
Yeah, time? The recovery is all the same. So you'll wake up pretty bruised and battered. So mm-hmm. definitely not going out for at least 2 weeks.
Unless you want some attention.
Yeah, that would work. You definitely get attention, no doubt about that. And then after that, particularly for women who are used to wearing makeup, you'd probably be able to camouflage the bruising with some makeup. So you'd probably be able to come out, go out and not sort of draw attention to yourself mm-hmm. unless you want to.
Yeah, yeah. How long? What kind of timelines are we talking about?
Oh, like every other operation, you know, bruising and swelling, you know, most of it would go by 2 weeks and then continuing to improve. You know, 6 weeks is usually a good landmark, and then probably even by 3 months. But when you look after that, it's more gradual. Mm-hmm. You look back at 12 months compared to 3 months, you go, oh, wow, I'm like so much less swelling.
Even some of the photos you've shown me in a week, I'm like, what do you mean they had one a week ago?
Yeah.
It's massive change quickly.
It does vary. Like, I mean, it depends obviously how much bruising you get. Mm-hmm. Like some people just do bruise a little bit more and then that makes it more obvious for a while.
Do you think combining facial surgeries with other like non-invasive procedures is a good combo or can work?
It can be, but you know, you should be able to probably avoid it. So, you know, let's say you're lifting the brow. So sometimes people have Botox in their forehead, so you shouldn't need that. Mm-hmm. The other place is sort of around the eyelid there as well. So that if you're doing a forehead as well, then that should improve that as well. And then filler. So we're lifting that cheek and giving more volume in the cheek. So shouldn't need that. And we'll often also do some fat grafting, particularly around the nose and mouth, sometimes in the lips as well.
Oh, interesting. From where?
Where do you put it in?
Where do you take it from?
Can take it from the tummy or inner thigh. Some people say, you know, one fat does better than the other, but then you see, you know, well-known plastic surgeons taking from one and some taking from the other. So, but each one says, oh, can you see the fat from here is so much better. And I'm like, it's fat.
Do you have a preferred?
Probably inner thigh.
What do you think the future of facial cosmetic surgery looks like?
I think we're, like with all surgery, we're heading more towards natural looks. So I think people want to look as natural as possible. I think people, you know, don't want any of those signs of having had a facelift. They want people to just say think they look better but not necessarily know what's changed. Maybe think they've just been on a holiday and just look relaxed. So I think moved a long way from even the early 2000s. The main fear I hear from patients is about facelifts is not, you know, are they going to wake up from the anaesthetic? You know, not are we going to damage the facial nerve? It's I don't want to look fake. I think people are more aware of surgery now, but want other people to maybe not be aware of it.
Yeah. If you liked this episode of Keeping It Real, please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, why don't you have a flick through our past episodes? We'd love to hear your requests for future topics, so send your suggestions through to us on IG at @RePlasticSurgery. That's all for today, and we'll catch you next time for another peek into the world of plastic surgery.